This week on Triangulation, Claire Evans and a book called Broadband, the story of, yes, women who made a huge difference in technology, going all the way back to Lady Ada Lovelace. It's all coming up next on Triangulation.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode 369, for Friday, October 19th, 2018. Claire Evans, Broadband. Triangulation is brought to you by LastPass. Secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 43,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology and hear their stories, talk about tech, talk about the future. Joining me today, a very interesting person, an excellent writer, and the author of a new book called Broadband, The Untold Story of Women Who Made the Internet. Claire L. Evans is here, pop singer, hello, journalist, and this is your first book. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
That's,
yes.
That's exciting.
It is.
The pop band, I have to say, interests me. Yacht.
Yeah, what do you want to know?
Well, it's good. And what it's interesting is it makes the name of the book a triple pun. Because you're in a band.
Yes.
It's good a band point. Of sisters. And it's Broadband. So we got three.
I like to operate on a minimum of three levels.
I like it. I really loved the foreword or the introduction because it's your story. Mm-hmm. And it's really, your writing is fantastic. I really enjoy how you put this together. But also, it's a very personal story. You have a Dell computer. I'm sorry, you had to learn on Windows, but that's how it is. She says, I've ran every Microsoft operating system from MS-DOS to Windows 95, and you had Get a Life written across the frame of the Dell in Sharpie, which I love. And you had, over time, it accumulated glitter, nail polish, and Post-it notes. It's a beautiful image about taking something grim and beige and industrial and making it your own.
It's what teenage girls always do. They always, you know, you gather all these little objects into your cave when you're that age, you know, stickers and concert tickets and notes from your friends, and you create this sort of strange little hermit crab castle of things that you think define you. And the computer was a big part of that for me growing up because it was this one-stop portal to all the possibilities of adulthood. I think I'm very fortunate in that I came of age in the what I think are the golden years of the World Wide Web, you know, when there was still a lot of possibility, a lot of strangeness, a lot of discovery, a lot of randomness. You know, you would fall upon these strange subcultures while, you know, surfing hyperlinks across without any clear plan or mission and find yourself in strange corners of the web all the time. And I really came of age that way, and I felt I became a writer in that period of time as well. I began to sort of understand my text in relationship to the screen, and the sort of feedback loop of seeing words on screen was really meaningful to me as a young woman. And, you know, as I grew older and blogging became something that you could authentically do for a living, kind of, I did a lot of that. And I always saw the computer as a kind of portal to the world, not necessarily gendered one way or the other, not for boys, not for girls. You know, it was just this way of pushing symbols around. And quite meaningful for me. My father worked for Intel, so we always had computers in the home and very early. And I think I also really loved the fact that, you know, my father's a very technical person, and I'm a very sort of, you know, symbol-oriented artist, humanist, writer person. And we could share a love of the computer, you know, even from a very early age. Even though we had different sort of vectors into it, we both got value out of it. And I think that's it's one of the kind of magical things about computing at its best, is that there are many different ways that are valid of interfacing with them across all disciplines and fields. And I think that that was a meaningful thing for me growing up. And it was important for me to include that kind of personal narrative in my introduction to the book, because I think everybody has their own their own path into this material.
I like it when people do that, because then I get to know you before you start talking about the meat.
Before I start bossing you around and telling you about all the people that you have to know about.
Well, and I think you nailed it. You hit technology at an inflection point. Mm-hmm. Because I'm an earlier generation, and in the earliest generation of Silicon Valley, anyways, very male dominated. Although women had been a part of computing history going back in time, but at that point, it was a lot of guys in white short sleeve shirts with pocket protectors and skinny ties, and it was an engineering thing, right? It was mm-hmm. it was all about the hardware, and right about that time that you got that Dell computer, it started becoming about software. The internet made it more about communication. A computer by itself, it's not much of a communication tool, but as soon as you get on the internet, that's all it's about. It became a thing. Content became more important than the hardware.
And that was really my approach moving into writing the book. I mean, it's a book about women, but it's also just a book about, I've read a lot of tech histories. It's one of my favorite genre of book. And I think, there tends to be this thing in tech history where, historians, people are pointing at the machines and saying, like, this box changed the world. This machine did this. And it's true that, a physical machine has a material presence in the world. Like, they mass produce tens of thousands of them. The world's landfills are full of computers that represent something important about the history of technology. But ultimately, they're just boxes. They're just, they're just transmuted rocks until people start doing things with them, and people start, bringing meaning to the screen and filling the containers with content, if you will. And that kind of sort of relational, human, social, community-oriented, user-oriented kind of history is something that I think has been lacking, and it happens to coincide quite, interestingly, or dovetail quite interestingly, with the history of female involvement in machines, perhaps because software has always been a place where women could find purchase more easily in the computing industry than hardware.
What prompted you to write this book? Why did it need to be written?
Well, it needed to be written, don't you think?
Oh, I think so, but I'm just going to give you a chance to say. I mean, obviously, it's been the story, a male, I think about Hidden Figures, where suddenly we learn that it's women of color who were so important to the early days of NASA. And and that certainly opened a lot of people's eyes. Is it analogous to that?
In a way, it's funny. I started writing this book right when Hidden Figures, the book, had just come out and was, I think, being optioned into the film that became the massive phenomenon that it was. And I found that, while talking to people, interviewing people for the book, that story, that Hidden Figures story, had such a huge impact on the public perception of women's involvement in computing history that it really kind of changed the conversation. There all of a sudden became this much more, widespread awareness of women's embodied relationship to computing history. So it's goes to show how powerful those narratives can be and how much they can affect the public perception of what our history is, our shared history is. But I it's a similar thing for me. I have always been interested in women's stories, being one, of course, and I've always been interested in computers, and I've always been, really attached to the experience of using computers. And I think that I had this moment maybe 3 to 5 years ago where I started to kind of reevaluate my lifelong relationship to the internet. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I was of a generation that really fell hard and fast for what the web represented and got a lot out of the web. And, something changed. I don't know. The internet changed. I changed. The world changed. And I started to feel as though my sense of self as a net native, as someone for whom the internet was my country, was kind of changing it's become harder to be a woman online than it perhaps used to be. There's always been bad actors. There's always been harassment and all that, even in the very earliest days of networked computing. But I think perhaps the increased emphasis on transparency and the lack of anonymity that we have as people in public space online, the vulnerability that creates, this sort of constant peanut gallery of criticism and feedback and harassment that is possible for any human woman that speaks about technology in a public space. All of that stuff started to make me feel as though I wasn't quite sure what my place was anymore in this territory. Wow. That I'd always taken for granted as being my own. And so I think, being someone who's interested in history and who likes to go, deep down rabbit holes, I decided that the best way to kind of reconcile that was to understand the history more thoroughly and to see what the lineage was and if there was a lineage that led up to and included someone like me. I'm not sure that the process of writing this book has entirely, you know, given me a full understanding of how to be a woman on the internet in 2018, but it has given me an understanding of, you know, the rights that I have to these spaces, I guess, you know, like this is, computing is very much historically a female domain, and it helps to know that, you know, it helps to feel as though I have some stake in this whole thing.
Interesting. I mean, had it not been, I still would say you have an absolute right to be on the internet and safely on the internet and fully. In fact, one of the things that we always thought the internet would be great for is that old New Yorker cartoon, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. You could write that on the internet. Sure. No one knows you're a girl. You get to be empowered. You talk about your first learning HTML with your first music band website. Mm-hmm. I've got to think that's MySpace, right?
No, earlier than that. Yeah, well, I mean, this is probably like a little bit TMI, but my earliest experiences creating websites were creating fan sites for the band Weezer.
Oh,
I didn't think I was going to say that. But yeah, you know, they had a very strong internet nerd fan community, as
that's
you can
right.
imagine.
That's, right.
That's how I learned how to make websites, so I could post pictures of Rivers Cuomo on the internet.
Aww.
Everybody has their point of entry. But yeah, you're right. I mean, in the early days of the internet, it was small enough and new enough to feel like something.
Everybody was
other.
Welcome. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a new domain and we could start anew. And a lot of these early cyberculture thinkers that I so love and admire, you know, imagined that we'd be entering into this democratic realm. The late John Perry Barlow wrote about a civilization of the mind in cyberspace, bless his heart. And all the early feminists to come online in the sort of late 80s, early 90s really wanted to claim the internet as a feminist space because they saw it as something that would be free from the boundaries of gender and that we could connect mind to mind without any of the limitations. You know, and what happened instead, which I, in retrospect, is fairly clear that, you know, instead of creating this new territory, we just brought everything with us into cyberspace because we're people and we always do that. You can't create a technology that gives you any real critical distance on the human experience, I don't think. You know, I think we invest ourselves too deeply and we bring the good and the bad. So I think, you know, all that utopian idealism of the first generations online, I look back at it with great fondness and I see it happening again and again with different things, you know, with blockchain or the decentralized. Mm-hmm. But I think we have to always remember that we can't improve matters in technology unless we improve ourselves.
Humans.
Before
we
go into. Yeah, which is, you know, gosh, a harder proposition.
You always got to have humans, don't you? They ruin
everything.
What
a drag.
I'm one of those hippies who really had those high hopes. And now you look back at John Perry Barlow's manifesto, and it's like, wow, that was naive. weren't we silly?
Yeah, but you know, I think sometimes you need to have those kinds of texts as a jumping off point,
sure.
if nothing else.
I mean, you got to start with hope, right?
I honestly don't even believe that John Perry Barlow believed as naively in all of that stuff because he was so foundational in, you know, in the EFF, and he knew what was worth fighting for, you know? He wasn't a fool. But I think it's important to have these kind of luminary texts that we bring with us that set at least our intentions and make it clear when we're deviating from an idealized approach.
So you start in the book. I mean, I think anybody who knows the history of computing knows the names of the kind of the earliest women in computing. Ada Lovelace, who designed with Charles Babbage the inference engine, and Lord Byron's daughter. And go ahead.
Yes, no, I mean, one is legally mandated to begin a history of women.
Right.
With someone like Ada Lovelace. That would have been laughed out of, you know.
Spend time, and I really love it, with Grace Hopper, which is fantastic. Amazing Grace is the name of the chapter.
Yeah, and Grace Hopper is one of these figures that's really often trotted out as kind of, you know, foremother of women in computing and this important kind of sticker book character, you know. And I think it's really, you know, can sometimes be reductive to have these heroes, because Grace Hopper was actually a very complex character. She had a lot of issues. She struggled a lot. She was in a very strange and interesting and kind of a very dark period of history. I mean, she was doing computing that was being applied to, you know, warmongering, essentially. I mean, she worked on the central calculation, implosion, you know, calculation for the atomic bomb. I mean, these are things, these are some of the darkest aspects of our history. And she also pushed really hard and was very tenacious during a very difficult period of the early computing industry. Just a fabulously interesting and complex character. And I think she's often reduced to the kind of like Grace Hopper on a t-shirt, right. Inspiring figure. And like all of these people, like all people, there's always so much more to the story and there's so much more nuance. And I think, you know, one of the things that I tried to resist in the book is, you know, lionizing people as these kind of paper cutout sticker book characters, because it's great to have heroes and it's important for, you know, young women to see that women can succeed in this field, and the representation is very key, and there's obviously a lot of hunger for that representation. But I don't get anything out of a simplified hero. You know, I want to have, you know, I don't think that the alternative to great man history is great woman history.
Right.
It's more like this much more complex, messy human being history, where we get to see how people interplay with one another, their foibles, their passions, their dramas, their idiosyncrasies. All of that stuff makes it more interesting. And it's much more valuable and instructive to see how somebody overcame difficulty, or, you know, succeeded in spite of certain things, you know, because that's I can learn from that more easily than just some idealized heroine.
And as you tell it, Admiral Hopper is an interesting character because she bridges two eras of computing. She starts in an era, the Hidden Figures era, where women were computers. They were human computational engines.
I mean, the development of the modern computer comes from human calculation efforts during World War II. You know, these women working in the basement of the war theater doing ballistics calculations and then getting hired to, you know, essentially manage or operate the earliest mechanical computers in this sort of secretarial, sort of telephone operator type capacity, not something that was considered to be privileged or required any real intellect. It's not until those women actually endeavored to translate math onto these machines that it became apparent that this was not an easy proposition and in fact required a great deal of sophisticated higher level systems thinking. And so Grace was really instrumental in that period. But then she took all of that thinking and that knowledge and that sort of, you know, everything that she learned from that period of history. And then she brought it with her into the early commercial computing industry and really advocated for what was then referred to as automatic programming, which was just this idea of moving beyond the machine level in order to code at a higher level of abstraction through, you know, the use of compilers and generators and assemblers and eventually programming languages. So She's more than just someone who patched cables during the war. I mean, she's really someone who advanced the art significantly.
You talk about a contemporary of hers in the 50s after the war, John Backus, who at IBM, who said that programmers were a priesthood in the 50s, guarding skills and mysteries far too complex for ordinary mortals. And she rebelled against that. She said, no, humans should be able to write programs.
Yeah, I mean, back in those days, I mean, this is before programming languages. This is before you could interface with the machine in any kind of, you know, symbols-oriented kind of way. This is writing programs at the binary level, at the machine level, really at the instruction set. So, you know, the people that were able to do that in any kind of sophisticated way had limitless patience and had a certain sense of probably hard-earned, proprietary kind of mysticism over the whole thing, because they knew what a dark art it was. And it's not so much that I think Grace wanted to break out of the priesthood, but she wanted to welcome as many people into it as possible. And she knew the only way to do that was to simplify the process, which would also in turn simplify the process of, you know, developing much more complex forms of software. So yes, she advocated for, you know, she was seen as kind of a space cadet for advocating for automatic programming. But ultimately, she was proven right.
She wrote COBOL.
Yeah.
Which today is kind of deprecated. COBOL. In fact, even in your time, people laughed at COBOL programmers. But it was huge in the 50s. At the Department of Defense ran all its computers, as you say in here, with COBOL. Insisted that suppliers provide hardware that supported it, dictating the direction of computing for a decade. COBOL... Mm-hmm. 10 years after its implementation, was the most widely used programming language in the industry. And by the turn of the millennium, this most recent millennium, was 80% of all the code on the planet was written in COBOL, 70 billion lines of code. That's kind of mind-boggling. That's a huge success.
It is a huge success. And it's, you know, I think it was a very well-timed intervention because at that period, you know, after the war, as the commercial computing industry was developing, there could have been, I mean, there kind of still was, but a major sort of Tower of Babel problem where everybody would be developing their own languages for their own specific hardware and there would be no interoperability. And it would be very difficult for, you know, software to keep up with hardware development, basically. So, creating something that had, you know, that was interoperable, that was approachable, that used something close to natural language. I mean, COBOL is a toughie, but still, it was much better than, you know, a elemental binary instruction set. That was really quite meaningful in terms of setting a kind of base layer for how we were going to move forward as a community into the sort of the future of computing.
But then there's a gap. You know, probably more modern times we're aware of women very much part of, you know, the computing industry, not still parity with men, but certainly they're around. But you don't think of the 60s, the 70s, and even the 80s as were there having any. So pretend I know nothing about women in computing in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, because I don't.
Yeah.
And it's all in here. And let's start with what Cosmo called the computer girls.
Yes. Well, I mean, in the 60s, almost half of the workforce in the computing industry was still female. There were a lot of female sort of systems operators, programmers. They were beginning to kind of cluster in this sort of lower status part of the industry.
It was kind of menial, like a telephone operator, right?
But there were still a huge amount of women in the field.
They were data entry kind of types.
Yes. Lower level, less of a supervising capacity, but more very much present in the field. And right. For a long time, you know, the work of inputting and collating and processing was seen as a woman's job. And women earned, I think, 40% of computer science degrees at American universities until 1984. So, I mean,
that's fascinating.
Yeah, there was a sizable female presence in computing for quite a while, but
what happened?
You know, well, everyone always asks me that, but there's a lot of different factors that I would say sort of inadvertently conspired to edge women out of the picture. There was, you know, always the usual stuff, you know, wage disparity and lack of childcare and lack of mentorship as that first generation of female programmers, Grace Hopper's generation, kind of aged out of the workplace. But also sort of a shift in the professional credentials that were required and the educational requirements that were necessary to get a job as a programmer. Because in the very early days, there was no, you know, there weren't really computer science departments at school. You couldn't get a degree in programming. Programmers came, you know, into the field kind of sideways based on aptitudes. You know, they were good at puzzles or they did well in math or they worked their way up from, you know, data entry. And you didn't really need to have a specific degree or be part of any kind of professional organization to be a programmer. And hence that kind of priesthood thing where it was kind of this field of misfits and weirdos who just happened to have the right aptitude to do the work, many of whom were women. But as the field became more, you know, commercially viable and there was more investment, there was more development, it's sort of this question of, you know, these wild card, you know, weirdo programmers who are sort of wandering in and doing their work became something that had to be more formalized, more professionalized. So, you know, there began to be different kinds of requirements, different associations. There was actually kind of this semantic shift that happened in the late 60s where people were no longer referred to as coders or programmers, but rather as software engineers, which, you know, has its own connotations about who is best qualified to do those kinds of jobs. So there was this kind of slow, implicit masculinization that happened throughout the sort of 60s and 70s. And, you know, there's lots of great technology historians who are much more qualified than I am to sort of get into the nitty-gritty of this stuff, many of whom I cite in the book. But the central idea is that the field began as feminine, it had to be made masculine through various means. And I think that seems to have set a male-dominant precedent that's only really reinforced itself over the years through, frankly, marketing more than most things. If you look at, you know, ads for computing products from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, they're, you know, you'll see a lot of like, so simple, even Susie can use it kind of ad copy. And then you look at like, you know, when I was a kid, movies and TV and commercials for computer games were always targeted towards young boys. I think about movies like Weird Science, where, you know, 8-year-old nebbish nerds design their own dream girl using the computer. There was just
not our best moment.
There was this kind of cultural force towards marketing and reinforcing this idea of computing as masculine. Yeah. I think it did a lot of damage. It took a generation to accomplish, but now we're in a position where women are very much in the minority and tech is perceived as being a boy's club, which is, you know, just historically straight up an anachronism. And I think it's important to remember that.
We're going to take a little break. We're talking right now with the author of a brand new book called Broadband, Claire L. Evans, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. But as you can see, we haven't even gotten to the internet, and there's a lot of pre-internet stuff in there. Yes. Book is available not only, you know, in actual physical dead tree form, but of course, on Kindle. And Claire reads the Audible version of this. And that I want to hear, because you've got a great voice, and I think this will be fun to hear it in your own words. So I'm going to get I have the print, but I'm going to still get the Audible version of it. Hey, we'll be back with more in Claire Evans and Broadband in just a little bit, but I wanted to tell you about LastPass. We started using LastPass. Actually, I've used LastPass for almost 10 years. That's how long they've been around. And man, the minute I found out I can keep all, first of all, I can have good, long, strong, unguessable, unbrute forcible passwords, and I don't have to memorize them. I could put them all in a secure password vault. I was sold on the idea. Then we had Steve Gibson interview the creator of LastPass, and Steve looked at the source code. Joe Segrest showed him everything, and Steve said, "This is incredible." He started using LastPass. Then something bad happened. Well, one of our engineers could never remember the passwords to our web servers and to our bank accounts and everything else he needed to get into. So he made a web page with all his passwords, except it was public. That's when we decided that our company needed LastPass. LastPass Enterprise protects your company from, I don't want to say from its employees, but let me put it this way. There was a study that showed that 81% of all employees share their passwords, and not just with other employees. Bad passwords cause 81% of all the breaches in the world. And so why don't you have some passwords protect you with LastPass? LastPass makes it easy. They can share passwords without, you know, losing access to corporate data. I can actually give our accountant the password to our QuickBooks and our bank accounts, but she can't see them. She can't use them. She just uses them to log in at her work computer. You have over 100 policies. You could set master password requirements. You can enable password resets, restrict access when needed. We actually force is a bad word. Encourage, force our employees to use two-factor authentication because we need to protect those passwords. And with the LastPass password generator, it's really easy to create unique passwords. And with LastPass's authenticator app, a verification button pops up in the employee's phone. They don't have to enter a 6-digit code or anything. They just say, yeah, I approve that login. That makes sure only they have access to those accounts. I can go on and on. I mean, LastPass is designed perfectly to keep your data safe. And of course, your vault is encrypted and decrypted at the device level. Only data stored in the vault is kept secret, even from LastPass, of course. The new password fill-in on iOS 12, I don't know if you've tried this yet, is fantastic. You know, you don't have to cut and paste passwords anymore. When you try to log into an app or a website, LastPass will fill it in for you. Same thing on Android Oreo. That is, couldn't be easier. And we're talking about the product used by 16.5 million people. It's the number one most preferred password manager. 43,000 businesses now use LastPass. We use it. There's a LastPass for everybody. There's LastPass Premium for personal use. At home, we use LastPass Families. That way, I can share passwords with my wife. You know, she needs the PG&E, you know, the utility bill account. She needs the cable bill account. So I just share it with her. It's easy. It's simple. If she changes it, I get the new password. You know, it couldn't be better. There's also something, and I got to plug this because I really am a believer in this. And it's a little bit, you know, maybe it's morbid, but if you pass away, does your family have access to your bank accounts? Can they go in there and settle your bills and do? Probably not, right? Unless you have LastPass. They have a new feature called Emergency Access that lets you designate somebody who can get access to your vault should you become incapacitated. There's a very nice kind of protection in there. I won't go into the details of how it works, but it protects your passwords, and yet in the event that they need it, your family can get access to it. I think that's important. That's a great reason to use LastPass at home. And of course, LastPass Teams for businesses of 50 or fewer, and what we use, LastPass Enterprise, it is just awesome. It's a no-brainer. I know you're already using LastPass. I don't have to tell you. Make sure your boss knows about it. It's the first application I install when I set up a new phone or a new computer. It should be absolutely required in every business. LastPass.com/twit to find out more. Tell your boss. If you're the boss, don't let your employees have access to the keys to the kingdom. LastPass.com/twit. Now, let's get back to Claire and broadband. Broadband is our topic today. We're talking about women in tech, and I don't think you'd have to, everybody understands two things. First of all, the history of technology has underrepresented women. In fact, in some eras, there's no women mentioned at all. And secondly, that we have I'm going to say three things. We have a big hiring crisis because I was stunned to hear that 40% of computer science graduates were women in the 50s. That because it's now what, 5%, 10%? It's dropped dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
And third, it ain't easy being a woman on the internet these days, so much so that a lot of women choose not to use gender-neutral handles.
Yeah, it's always been a little bit weird to be female online. I think one of the things that really struck me in this research was when I was writing a chapter about early, early online communities. I'm talking BBS systems from the late 80s. You know, the kinds of problems that women face online today were already there in the late 80s. I mean, there were already women complaining about harassment, women having issues with, you know, being kind of constantly bothered by other male users. And a lot of people would choose gender neutral or male pseudonyms in those spaces just, you know, not to be bothered. And
frankly,
that's
one advantage of the internet is you could do that. If you're a woman in the workplace, now, thanks to the Me Too movement, you're screwed. Well, that's a bad choice of words, but it's not good.
It's not great. I mean, it's not good when there's no accountability, and it's not good when you're not heard.
And you shouldn't have to hide. Yes, you should be able to be yourself.
Exactly. Yes. But, you know, it's a complex issue. It always has been. There are many ways that we can work together to make it better for everyone without, you know, changing the discourse too radically. I think it just comes down to fundamentally being decent to other people on the internet, which is something that we have struggled with even from the very beginning. But, you know, a good rule of thumb is, you know, don't say things to people online that you wouldn't say to them to their face.
Right.
It was true then and it's true now.
And I do want to say that this is not a manifesto. This is not about, you know, the abuse women take on the internet. This is a real history that brings out some fascinating stories. When I first got on a system called CompuServe, one of my first online experiences, spent literally hundreds of hours. Fortunately, I was on a Compt account. Because I had to dial it up, put the modem. You don't remember this. Put the modem in the suction cups.
In the cradle, yeah.
And pray nobody picked up the extension while I wandered through Colossal Cave.
Which was,
you know, I had played Pong. I had an Atari. But man, that was the best experience I'd ever had. I was immersed in that cave. What I didn't know until I read your book is that it's a virtual map of Mammoth Cave.
Yeah, I got I could have written an entire book about that chapter.
This is frankly, fascinating.
It's endlessly fascinating. But yeah, the game Adventure originally, then like Colossal Cave Adventure, was written by a man, William Crowther, who had been a very avid caver and was part of a caving community in Kentucky of people exploring and charting Mammoth Cave, the largest cave in the world. And his ex-wife, Pat, was part of the party that made a very, very important discovery about Mammoth Cave, which substantiated it as the largest cave in the world. It's known as the Everest of speleology. She connected two cave systems in Kentucky and proved definitively that Mammoth Cave was 435 miles long, I believe. Wow. So she's this kind of legendary caver, this tiny woman who was able to pass through a very small passage between two caves and make this important symbolic link between these two cave systems. And I find it so fascinating and remarkable that, you know, her husband, who worked on the ARPANET at BBS, BBN, he made links with routers. I mean, he wrote the software for the earliest routers on the ARPANET. So what a strange connection and a story about connection. And ultimately, he wrote Colossal Cave Adventure based on a section of that cave that he and his wife had mapped together before their divorce.
That's the really fascinating thing. He was broken up about the divorce and wrote the adventure.
Yeah, because he and Pat had been the mapping crew on these caving expeditions. And the important thing to remember about caving is that, you know, there's no way to summit a cave. It's not like you climb to the top of the mountain and look down and see what you've done. The only way to accomplish, you know, having gone through an entire cave is to create a map of it. That is the caving community's equivalent of summiting. So the people making maps are these really important members of the team. And Will and Pat had been making computerized maps because they were both programmers. And they were some of the earliest computerized maps ever made of caves. And they would go and plot these maps from, you know, their survey guidebooks and make these massive, you know, plotted rolls of maps. And so, and that's the same computer that they used to plot those maps ultimately was ruggedized and became an early ARPANET router. So it's this weird story of connection and coincidence and quite beautiful. And I think, you know, I chose to include that story because I think it shows how human all of this is. You know, I think we often forget how human technology really is, and we have the sense of the internet or of whatever our, you know, platform of choice is as being something that fell fully formed from the sky, completed and finished and unchangeable. We have this kind of fatalistic attitude about technology, but everything that we use is the consequence of a lot of decisions and very specific human stories. I mean, perhaps a brokenhearted person wrote this game that changed your life, or perhaps, you know, a hardworking programmer, you know, who cut her teeth during World War II created this language that then became the backbone of all modern, you know, computers and partially was responsible for Y2K. I mean, all of these things are interrelated and profoundly human. And I think once you realize that, and once you really fully kind of grok that, then it makes you realize how things are still very mutable and things are in flux, and we don't have to accept things as they are. We can move with things and make decisions and choices that can influence the way that these technologies turn out.
I have to read this paragraph. Will stayed home to take care of their 7 and 8 year or 8 and 6 year old girls. And Pat went on to finish that mapping adventure that connected the two caves. You're right. When Pat came home, deeply moved by the experience, Will was waiting for her. They stayed up late, holding each other and talking about the connection. When Will fell asleep, Pat crept to the teletype terminal in the living room and entered as quietly as she could the bearings of the survey they'd made in Kentucky. She ran a coordinate program, and the data spooled into her hands in the form of a long paper tape. In the morning, Pat and Will brought the tape to his office, and she watched the BBN computer plot the link she'd made beneath the earth between two vast and lonely places. Now I can sleep, she wrote. I'm never going
to... I know.
And if you played Zork, by the way, that's just the more modern version of Colossal Cave. So you've played... Almost everybody's played this game. And
yes. Yes.
Wow.
It's kind of like... It's this foundational text of computer culture. I mean...
Absolutely.
Adventure is responsible for turning a lot of people onto computers and opening up the possibilities of what we could do with these machines. It's really one of the earliest kind of... I mean, it's the earliest computer game as we understand it today. And just the idea that you could have fun or make something beautiful or artful or immersive using, you know, the vector of the screen and just some words was, you know, a generation defining thing.
It was kind of mind blown as I'm reading this. Mammoth cavers, the real world cave, who tried adventure found they needed no maps. It was so accurate they could navigate it from memory. As the game spread, adventure players who made pilgrimages to the real Mammoth Cave could scramble down the twisting passageways, secure in their knowledge of the game's virtual map. Wow. There's no angry dwarfs throwing axes. There's no XYZZY or plug, but...
Nope, no battery dispensing machines or underground volcanoes. The core of it is there.
I literally gasped when I read that.
It's a hell of a story. And the funny thing is, the story of adventure is something that's it's really been trotted out a lot in tech histories as being this kind of, you know, this important foundational story about this guy who was a caver. And I had read the story many times in many forms, and it was only as I was kind of nosing around the footnotes of one or another one of these tellings that I realized that there was a huge missing piece, which was the story of Patricia, who was at Will's side in all these caving expeditions that formed his understanding of that space, and who catalyzed his desire to make this program, and that he had made this program for his daughters. You know, he had never intended adventure to be played by anyone but his kids. He just happened to have left a compiled version of the game on an early version of the ARPANET, spread like wildfire, as these things do. It was one of the first, cultural documents to be viral online, if you will, because it really propagated across every node of that early network. So, yeah.
Wow, what a story. Now let's head into the 70s.
Okay.
And this is so much fun for me because, as somebody who is like you, read every computer history I can get my hands on, it's eye-opening to read kind of the stories that were buried of the women who were involved with this stuff. I was an early user of The Well. I loved The Well. And of course, I credit Stuart Brand and all of that, but I didn't know anything about Sherry Raisin or Project One. Tell us about Project One.
Project One is an interesting one. I mean, it was this commune in San Francisco. Well, the thing is, a lot of tech histories are really in love with this period and place of time, which is San Francisco in the mid to late 1970s.
We interviewed John Markoff about what the Dormouse said.
Which, great, one of the great tech history books. Yeah. I think one of the better kind of human-oriented histories. Yeah. But, there is this kind of fantasy of the utopian ideals of the early cyber thinkers in this time in the 70s of people, who are really coming to understand the possibilities of what it would mean to bring people together and to sort of inflect computing with the values of the counterculture of that time. So there was this quite remarkable urban commune in San Francisco in those days called Project One, just a warehouse south of Market that a group of several hundred hippies turned into a sort of working indoor village, if you will, like this weird ecosystem where everybody had little areas, little mini houses built inside of this massive warehouse. And a lot of different kind of cultural production offices were there. But they also had a quite large computer, an SDS 640, I believe.
940.
Which they had procured because of the tenacity of really one woman.
I'm correcting you only because I have the book in front of me.
No, don't worry. It's fine.
I wouldn't have known otherwise.
Mansplaining the SDS 940 to
me. It's not like, if you knew, it's a... No, it's because I'm looking at the chapter.
there's some scholarship to suggest that the SDS 940 that they had at Project One was the very same that Douglas Engelbart's lab had that was an early node of ARPANET at Stanford. So it's another one of these kind of mystical machines that's connected to a lot of human stories. But this group of hippies who were living in an old candy factory, in the 70s in San Francisco, had managed to get their hands on a very expensive, significant piece of hardware because of the tenacity of one woman, this woman, Pam Hart English, who basically just called every single person she could think of, fundraised, and finally negotiated with a leasing company that she would take this old piece of hardware off their hands as like a tax write-off, and managed to bring this really powerful machine into the hands of the counterculture. And that machine was used for this project called Community Memory, which is this very sort of important early kind of social network, I suppose. It was they had various different terminals around the Bay Area, and hippies would use it as a message board. Off-cited in tech history as well. And it was used for a number of different kind of innovative community-oriented computing projects, one of which was called the Social Services Resource Directory, which was a project that was spearheaded and run by a group of women and really has not been written about in any other history as far as I know. And it was this project to create a centralized database of social services for social workers in the Bay Area. So they basically called every single social worker, every domestic abuse shelter, any place that would offer resources for people in need in the Bay Area, and ask them to share information and pool information into this larger database that would then be distributed on paper to all the social service offices in the Bay Area. And it became this incredibly important lifeline for a lot of people, people without resources, people without access to tools, if you will. And it wasn't really sort of seen as a technological object because it was the database was printed out on paper and distributed because people, the people who used it could not afford, you know, teletype machines. But it was used by social services and social workers in the Bay Area until like 1996 or something. Really like a massive sort of long running, unglamorous project. And something I think is interesting about this history and comes up a couple of times as well in different stories in the book is, you know, a kind of abiding and longstanding concern for caring for projects once they have been initiated. I think a lot of our thinking as a culture about what is worthy and what is worth, you know, mythologizing in tech is this idea of serial entrepreneurship, of founding companies and making a ton of money and aggregating a lot of users and then perhaps selling those companies and disarticulating the products from the users and moving on to bigger and better and brighter and more exciting things. But there's something to be said for people who start things and then continue to do them, even if they're not glamorous or cool or interesting or lucrative, you know, something like the Social Services Resource Directory, which is really just an application of computing power to social good that benefited nobody but the people in need. You know, it's something that we don't include in our prevailing mythologies about what makes tech cool and great, but it's actually what it should be all about, I think. And I think something that really deserves much more focus and attention. So, I don't know. That's what I think is remarkable about Project One is this group of women working on this very tedious but very important database for people in the Bay Area.
You mentioned in the book, and I wish I could find this picture, that Rolling Stone wrote an article about it in 1972, the profile of Pam Hart English, which called it one of the greatest hustles of modern time.
And, yep.
And featured a picture of her taken by Annie Leibovitz next to the console. And I wish I could find that picture. I've been looking for it.
I can send it to you. I have a copy of
it.
I
would love to see
it. I tried to license it for the book, but Annie Leibovitz, it's a tricky one.
A little pricey.
But yes, I mean, she was the sort of like mother of this weird group of hippies working towards the application of computing to social good. You know, what a hero.
And it's interesting because it's a proto version of, I think what, boy, I hope this isn't sexist. Slap me around if it's wrong. What women have brought to the internet, which is instead of this kind of, you know, there are plenty of female engineers who think in ones and zeros and black and white, but instead of using technology to launch missiles, use technology to bring us together and to help one another. And in the 70s, that was pretty early days to be doing that. I think nowadays with the internet, we kind of are more aware of how that's happened.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I don't think that's incorrect. I think that, you know, I always hesitate to say that women are essentially better or more interested at one pursuit over another.
Yes,
but
I
do
that
think that throughout technology history, these spaces which have allowed purchase for women tend to have been these more user-oriented spaces, partially because they're not as privileged in the field. You know, I think software was seen as less than hardware for a long time, and it wasn't until, you know, its importance became apparent that the primarily female group of people that was working in that field got kind of edged out. And that happens a lot. And things like, yeah, the application, community applications, early community building, a lot of that was spearheaded by women who had an interest in that kind of thing, but also who saw it as a place where they could make a mark much more freedom and ease than perhaps, you know, writing programming languages or compilers or entering into the higher levels of academic computer science or becoming hardware engineers or things which perhaps were a bit more challenging in terms of the workplace. There's a whole chapter in the book about hypertext, which was an incredibly convivial field for women as well. And again, because I think it was seen as being, you know, kind of soft social sciences, you know, much more fluffy and people oriented than serious programming, but ultimately became something that was, you know, became foundational to the way that we interface with each other in the modern world, which is something that a generation of female computer scientists and researchers realized long before the web came along. So there are these kind of points, these points of access that tend to be more user oriented historically that have allowed women to make an impact. But I don't think that necessarily means that women are like naturally good at doing that kind of thing. I think it's just the place where it works. And, you know, collectively you look at the history and you see that kind of thing happening again and again. And I do think women have done an excellent job in that domain. And I think women could have done an excellent job in any domain that they felt comfortable participating in ultimately.
There's so many stories in here. I'm going to have to pick only a handful because we don't want to keep you all day. Although I have been okay. known to do that. I mentioned the well, and of course, Community One, Community Memory and Resource One, and the SDS eventually kind of transmogrified into something called the Whole Earth Electronic Link that Larry Brilliant and Stuart Brand started. And we've been talking about that in other interviews we've done on this show. We talk a lot about computer history. And you mention a woman who's going to be in the studio in a couple of hours, Naomi Pierce, in here.
Oh, really?
Yes, her husband Sal is coming on this afternoon. We're going to do a triangulation with Sal Segoyan. And Naomi's an old friend, dear friend, and was also on the well back in those days.
Yeah.
She was one of the deadheads that populated the well. On the well, you use your handle was so short, I think it was three letters, that there was no gender on the well.
I'm sure that there was. I think there's a chapter in the book about an early social network called Women's Wire, which was an offshoot of the well, which was founded by a couple of well heads who felt as though, you know, it was supposed to be this whole earth electronic link that represented all people. But ultimately, it was a bunch of, you know, mid-30s white guys. And so they went off and started their own service explicitly targeted to women called Women's Wire, which ultimately became
where all the women went.
Women.com. Yeah, they all left.
That's one of those mid-30s white guys. I was going, where did they all go? All right.
Yes, they started another service, which ultimately became women.com was like a massive like .com era boom time company, kind of another remarkable story in of its own. But yes, there were several offshoot kind of BBSs that had, you know, slightly better parody than the well. The well, of course, is a marvelous and foundational place. There's a chapter in the book about this woman, Stacey Horn, who founded the kind of East Coast equivalent of the well, a service called Echo, which at a time when the internet was, you know, really like about 10 to 15% female, Echo had a 40% female user base, and all of its moderators, every conversation was moderated by two hosts, a male host and a female host. So she worked really hard to create a system that would be more welcoming to women than other services that she'd experienced had been. And it's another one of these, you know, amazing early internet communities that still exists and is still Unix based.
Echo is still around?
Echo's still around. I got a membership when I was writing the book. It's there's still an active community of hardcore users, just as the well is still around. I mean, some people, you find your community and you stick with it. Yeah. And I think that's admirable too. And ultimately, you know, I don't know, having a Unix based BBS that has lasted since 1989, that's an incredible feat of you know, again, of technological care and stewardship. And it's become this remarkable historical document. And if you go and look at Echo and you search for 9/11 or the Anita Hill hearings or the O.J. Simpson Bronco chase, you can find conversations that happened in real time as those things were going down. And it's absolutely remarkable because you can really see how, you know, real people lived and thought and talked about these things. It's probably not going to be able to do that, you know, in 20 years time for Facebook or for Twitter. It's going to be much harder to search that material and actually make it useful. So
the Echo is not exactly easy to use. You have to SSH into it. The commands are things like J and then a three-letter abbreviation to join a group. Then you have to use 0 to say who's online. I mean, it's a non-trivial.
It's non-trivial.
And I think that's part of its appeal.
Yeah. For me, I mean, I suppose I'm a millennial. I think I'm a slightly older millennial. But, you know, there is something really appealing about that kind of thing. I mean, when I was writing this book, I was spending a lot of time on BBSs, on multi-user domains and moos and mushes and these kind of strange early internet spaces just to sort of understand the physics of it all. And I kept honestly blew my mind. The only comparison I can think of is, you know, when I was a teenager and I realized that when you put a needle on a vinyl record, it makes sound. Like, you know, this technology that seemed to be so self-apparent for a generation previous, when you discover it when you're younger, it's to know that you can still to this day go to a multi-user domain and, you know, and like chat to people in a simulated text space using this very specific kind of physics, and that there are still people there and that it still works and you can just, you know, dial into it through the terminal on your Mac. I mean, there's something kind of magical about that, sort of peeling back all of the layers of all of the semantics and all of the symbolism and all of the capitalism and all the centralization and all the stuff that has come afterwards, to go back to the sort of skeletal original thing and just actually have a conversation with somebody is genuinely kind of magic feeling. And I sort of have a pet theory that millennials will get really into BBS as a sort of reactionary analog
that.
Thing. I don't think I'm right, but I really want to be right.
And they'll all be playing Colossal Cave Adventure and
we'll be playing weird door games on BBSs and you know, I don't know, who knows?
We have a 15-year-old and I look at him and the games he plays with his friends, a lot of them are 8-bit games that look a lot like the games, you know, I played on my Atari VCS. They're very primitive. Mm-hmm. And they love those old games. So
yeah, the physics of what makes things feel real and immersive isn't about how high res and high def and, you know, like fast things are. It's about like, you know, collaboration with others. I think you can be in the most 8-bit environment, and if you're chatting to somebody in real time, you might as well be like on the holodeck because it works.
Right.
You know? And I think people are starting to realize that. You don't need to throw a bunch of resources into, you know, skinning something so it looks hyper real. Ultimately, that's just creepy.
That's right.
I'd rather just have fun, you know?
The brain is much better than a Xeon-based
Well, that's computer. Why we still write books, right? I mean, it's just words on paper, but it still sucks us into the story as perhaps more evocatively than a film or any other form of media. I'm still a big adherent of the theater of the mind that happens when you just read a book.
We're talking to Claire L. Evans. She's the author of Broadband, a new book about the untold story of the women who made the internet. I think you'd sell yourself short with that subtitle because it's really so much more than that. It's really these great anecdotes and stories about the history of computing. And
thank you.
Naturally, there's plenty of women throughout. Women like Jake Feindler, fascinating story, who was downstairs from Doug Engelbart.
At the Stanford Augmentation Lab. She is an extremely fascinating character, and I actually just had the honor of inducting her into the Women in Technology International Hall of Fame because of the book. She was the sort of central organizing force of the early ARPANET. I mean, when the ARPANET was coming together, there was no way to search for the resources that you needed if you were trying to access another computer on the network. The only way that you would find out how to connect and where the things that you needed to connect to were by calling this office at Stanford called the NIC, the Network Information Center, which was run by Jake Feindler, this woman who was an information scientist, a librarian, essentially. And she answered the phone for the internet for 17 years, I believe. And people are always blown away when I tell them that there was a phone number you could call for the internet if you had a question. And it used to just be one phone, and then it was a bank of 10 phones ringing off the hook 24 hours a day because, of course, the thing grew exponentially. But Jake and her staff, which was mostly female, you know, they answered that phone. They created the early documentation for the ARPANET. They created the sort of yellow pages and white pages. They created Whois. She's responsible for, you know, the idea of naming different domains, .com, .edu, .gov. So she's this very sort of structurally foundational, central figure in the development of the ARPANET. And she's been like almost completely written out of the history until now, which is just truly nuts when you actually talk to her, because she was, you know, she was coming in at 3 a.m. and leaving, you know, after midnight, you know, every day, pulling all nighters with people in the lab, like trying to keep the internet online and keep it in check in these very, very early formational periods. And she's very humble about it. But really a remarkable woman, interesting woman who had a really first person view on the development of this unprecedented thing. And she's in her, you know, late 70s now, and she's finally kind of getting recognition. Good. And it makes me so happy because she's really such a cool lady. And it's important. It's important to you know, give these people their due while they're still with us.
There's before there was Tim Berners-Lee and the World Wide Web, before our friend Bill Atkinson wrote HyperCard, there was Kathy Marshall at Xerox PARC. And
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, hypertext is an amazing thing because, you know, before the World Wide Web came along, there was a whole research community of people working in hypertext for nearly 10 years, developing systems that weren't built on the backbone of the internet, but which you know, worked out all the fundamental physics of how we should link ideas together, how we should, you know, make it so that this massive amount of digitized information that computer memory makes possible can actually be navigated and, you know, transformed into useful, applicable, you know, real world knowledge through linking. And there was a lot of really interesting and intelligent and bright and, you know, forward thinking women building systems that would help us do that, help us make connections, help us both on the sort of an argumentation side, you know, like Kathy Marshall at Xerox PARC worked on the system called Note Cards, which predated HyperCard, which was a similar kind of system of, you know, linking these little cards, like the way that you write, you know, your junior high papers, like with index cards, 3x5 index cards linked together across, you know, as though they were pinned on a corkboard with string, and then getting more and more sophisticated, of course. And so, yeah, and so when by the time the web came along, you know, the entire hypertext community took one look at it and thought that it wasn't going to go anywhere because, you know, the links on the web were contextual, they were embedded in documents, they could break. You know, there was the possibility of what we now call a 404 error. And all these earlier hypertext systems, links could go in two directions. Links could go in multiple places. Links could be scaled and changed depending on the user. So you could get a more sort of sophisticated set of links for someone who's a more advanced user. There was much more kind of granular sort of control and specificity over what you could do with these systems. But I think the web was radically simple and free and online, and that made it so that it eclipsed all these other earlier hypertext systems. But I think it's always important to remember from whence technologies emerge. I mean, the web is one of those things where, you know, it borrowed a lot of concepts from these earlier systems, but it's more like these earlier systems created the conditions for the web to emerge because there was an ongoing discourse for a long time about how best to approach this issue. And, you know, Tim Berners-Lee kind of came at it sideways ultimately. There's a really great story, which I believe is in the book, although I can't remember how much detail I go into it. But the very first time the World Wide Web was demonstrated in the United States was at Hypertext 91, the 1991 Hypertext Conference in San Antonio, Texas. And Tim Berners-Lee's paper about the web didn't get accepted to the conference for whatever reason. I think because the hypertext community saw it as being, you know, kind of a lesser than technology. Right. But he came anyway, and he lugged his, you know, $10,000 Next Cube on his own dime from CERN, and he set it up in sort of the demos period of the conference, which was after all of the papers and talks of the day, simultaneous with the kind of meet and greet cocktail hour of the conference. And so there's this anecdote that several people who were there have told me, which is that the very first time the web was being demonstrated to anyone who might be interested in the United States, everybody was outside drinking margaritas because there was a margarita fountain as part of the cocktail hour. This is San Antonio in the summer. And so all of these hypertext people were in the courtyard getting, you know, blotto on margaritas, and nobody went to go look at the web because they were like, who cares? And there is one photo of Tim Berners-Lee at Hypertext 91. And if you look closely, you can see a margarita glass on the folding table right next to the Next Cube, which must have made him a little bit nervous. And it's remarkable to think that, you know, less than a year later, he was the king of the world, basically. I mean, he was the keynote speaker at the next Hypertext conference, and the World Wide Web conferences came along, and Hypertext as a discipline kind of petered out. And these things happen very, you know, very, very quickly. But it's remarkable to think that there was a period in time where everybody was more interested in getting a free margarita than looking at the web. You know, a little bit of context.
It's a kind of an example of where the perfect is the enemy of the good. That they had Microcosm, which was written by Wendy Hall, and they had these, you know, it was really sophisticated. And Tim is showing something that's, you know, kind of primitive. And they thought, you know. Okay, nice. Nice little demo you got there, but we got something much better.
Yeah, and it happens all the time like that in tech. And I, you know, that sometimes that has to be the way it is. And I think ultimately, you know, the fact that we can have dead ends on the web, which was considered to be this kind of the fundamental reason why it would be not a valuable hypertext technology. You know, the fact that we have 404 errors, I think ultimately is a good thing because it allows us to sort of, I don't know, like the natural decay of things is important on a certain level. And the fact that, you know, the web is often kind of sort of shedding its past and reinventing itself and rewriting itself is part of what I think has made it such a lasting and powerful thing. And yes, the simplicity of it, you know, I think academics have a hard time with simplicity, and that's, you know, they saw that as a flaw, but I think it ultimately was an advantage.
Yeah.
But I do often think about what would happen if one of, you know, what would have happened in the parallel future if, you know, one of these other more sophisticated systems had taken off in the same way that the web did. You know, what kind of internet would we be using today if all links went in two directions or multiple directions, or, you know, there was much more kind of granular accountability about sourcing and attribution. I don't know. Maybe we would be living in a more civil world, perhaps. Maybe we wouldn't even be interested in the internet because it wouldn't have the same affordances as it has today. But I do think it's always satisfying to ponder the potential parallel possibilities of history.
So many great stories in here, and so well written. It's really engaging. It draws you in. It is not a polemic by any means, although I think when you get to the end of it, you might say, boy, it's a shame that we never heard these stories before. Is there one story that I haven't brought up, one person that I haven't brought up that you think ought to be better remembered?
Oh, boy. I think you've done a pretty good survey of all the heavy hitters in the book. I mean, the thing is that's important for me to remember and to state is that I really don't want this book to be, you know, oh, it's done now. You know, like the book's done. The stories have been told. We're good. You know, we've covered it. Because there's tons and tons of stuff that I wasn't able to put in the book just for the length, for the sake of length and the sake of narrative. But there are many other stories I wish I could have told. I wish I could have included that I hope other people will take on and tell, because there really is just kind of a maddening wealth of material, actually. I mean, the fact that, you know, we always hear the same 10 stories, you know, about like Steve Jobs hiring the guy from Pepsi or whatever, like when there's all this other stuff that is just as interesting and tantalizing and provides this, you know, for me, it's not so much about creating some kind of counter history. It's about adding more complexity to the history that we have. Like, we have the foundation. We understand the stories that have brought us to where we are today. Now here's a bunch more that complicate those narratives and just show you the perspective from someone standing in a different part of the room and looking at the same thing. You know, what else can we learn about this incredibly important, you know, transformative period in our technological history? Why don't we take a look at the people that were also in the room who might have had a different perspective on that? I think it only enriches it, and it only brings more nuance and more subtlety and more complexity to the story, which for me makes for a better story.
Yeah, it doesn't complicate it. It enriches it. And this is definitely an enriching book. The book is Broadband, the Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet, but also everything else that we use today. Claire L. Evans. It's available everywhere from Penguin. And there's a great audio version of it that Claire reads at audible.com. I know a lot of you use Audible. It's a great read. It's very engaging, and I'm so glad we could spend some time together. Thank you, Claire.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This has been really fun.
Broadband, everybody, buy it now. Thank you. ClaireLEvans.com if you want to get a copy. That's probably the best place to do it, ClaireLEvans.com. Thanks, Claire.
That'll do it. Thank you so much.
Take care. We'll talk about Yacht another time.
Okay.
I love the music.
Oh, thank you very much.
It's really good.
Thank you.
I mean, it's, you know, it's so funny because we like to pigeonhole people. Oh, yeah, she's a writer, she's an editor, whatever. And why can't you be a pop star and a great writer and everything else?
You know, people writing songs and writing books is definitely not the same thing, but it does take some of the same,
muscles?
Dedication. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, a living.
Good. Well, you can find Yacht on YouTube if you want to hear some of their music. Thank you. Take care, Claire.
All right. Have a good day.
Bye-bye. We do triangulation every, it varies. I was going to say every Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific, but in fact, this was done at noon, so that doesn't work. But keep an eye on the schedule at twit.tv/calendar, because it's always fun. It's always interesting. Some of the best, most interesting people in technology, we do our best to bring them to you on triangulation. And if you watch live, you could participate by chatting in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. We will have a show 3 p.m. Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, 2200 UTC. Sal Segoyan will be joining us later today with Naomi Pierce, his wife. But anytime, are they married? Or I think they are. I hope I'm not marrying them. Inappropriately, but I believe they are. Anyway, Sal will be here to talk about AppleScript Automator and the future automated systems on triangulation. And there'll be another great one next week and the week after, too. So make sure you tune in. And better yet, just subscribe. If you go to twit.tv/TRI, you can download every episode. Look for people that interest you. There's a picture of me with Daniel Suarez, author of Demon and Freedom. We've had some great interviews with Bill Atkinson, the creator of HyperCard. Adam Fisher's new book, The Valley of Genius, interviews with the people who created Silicon Valley, and on and on and on. You'll find them all at twit.tv/TRI. Megan and Jason help out, too, of course. They do a lot of the interviews as well. And if you want, you could subscribe. There's a thought. That way your phone or your computer would be loaded up with great things to listen to whenever you're in the mood. Apple's podcasts, iHeartRadio, Overcast, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, SoundCloud. I can go on and on. We're everywhere. Subscribe, that way you'll get every episode. Thanks for joining us, and I'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.